Senator Whale.
The Senate's action on troops for Europe carries out the purposes of the resolution introduced by me last January the 8th, which has focused the attention of the Congress and the country upon the great issues involved. While I am personally gratified, the important thing is the Senate has struck a blow for preservation of the principle of the Constitution that Congress, representing the people, is master of the military establishment and not the president.
And the Democrats claim the resolution is no more than the wish of the Senate. Senator Tom Connally called it a great Truman victory. So did Senate Majority Leader Ernest McFarland of Arizona.
By an overwhelming vote, the Senate approved the sending of four American divisions of ground troops to implement the North Atlantic Treaty. The Senate thus gave a clear warning to Joseph Stalin that the people of the United States are determined to stand by their allies.
No one can say how much damage the months of debate and confusion has caused in Europe among our allies, 3,000 miles nearer the threat of Russia. And the situation remains almost as it was before the debate began. Senator McCarthy of Wisconsin managed to get in an amendment saying that Spain and West Germany should be brought into the Atlantic Pact. This is all merely advice and counsel and does not have the force of law. While all this torrent of wordage poured forth from Washington, the man at the other end of the line, with the toughest job of his life ahead of him, officially got down to work. General Dwight D. Eisenhower talked to a news conference.
The only reason for me being before you today is this. This morning at 1 minute after midnight, it was decided that I should take over formally and officially the responsibility of command in chief. I haven't the advantage that a commander usually has in the when he's handling operations in the field of coming to you with some long record of its success and victory or operations in which I can get up and make myself look good by a very long tale of how deeply responsible I was for all these nice things. Here we're talking about a job of work. It's serious work. It's hard work.
General Eisenhower talks of congressional delay and the real heart of our problem in Europe.
The question is, how much effect will any further delay in this congressional action in the United States have upon the spirit and the will to resist in Western Europe? I know this only, ladies and gentlemen. This problem on which we have collectively embarked is specifically one of the heart, one of confidence. There is in Western Europe and in the United States and in the free world sufficient force, sufficient power, and a sufficient array of resources to take care of ourselves and make sure we are not attacked. As long as we are peaceable, do not become aggressive, and as long as we are animated by some basic desire for security toward a common purpose. If we will unify ourselves in a common understanding, this thing can be done. Can be done promptly. So anything that seems to me to indicate a reluctance to get into this pool of cold water, clear up to our necks, is something that I deplore, because I believe that we must all show, one to the other, the United States to France, and France to Holland, and Holland to us, and so on, that we are ready to do our part to preserve freedom. I sometimes think, ladies and gentlemen, I repeat this thing ad nauseum. You must get weary of hearing me say it, but I believe it completely. If our hearts are in this thing, it can be done.
General Eisenhower and his growing staff are already hard at work. Every day, Monday through Friday, the high brass and the low brass file into classrooms for their daily French lesson.
Mon père a une grande maison.
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 Bon, Captain Sanders, s'il vous plaît, répétez la même phrase.
Mon père a une grande maison.
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 Non, c'est le Z. Z. Maison.
Maison.
Maison. You see, when the S is between two vowels, you pronounce it like a Z.
Maison.
Maison. Non, Z.
Maison.
Non, c'est Z.
S.
Non, Z.
S.
Like a Z. Une grande maison.
Une grande maison.
Bon.
With General Ike's new team quickly adjusting to the new life and language of their new headquarters, A lady from Europe of some fame was orienting herself and her children to life in the United States. Rita Hayworth, the wife of the Ali Khan, was back in the United States.
I'm thrilled to be back home again, and I'm most grateful for the very warm reception that you all have given me. And, of course, I'm most anxious for my children to see America. And, you know, the first thing I'm going to do is go out and get myself a hot dog.
This week in America, an age-old custom changed. It was announced that on the recommendation of high authorities in the field of education, and with the approval of Draft Director Hershey and the President, certain promising college students would be deferred from the draft in order to permit the fullest possible utilization of the nation's technological, scientific, and other critical manpower resources. What this means is that if you can pass an aptitude test and receive high academic grades in your studies, you will not be drafted, you will be deferred. This is something new in an America which has never tried to decide who should carry a rifle on the basis of his intellectual horsepower. We wondered how the youth of our nation were responding to this new regulation. We decided that rather than sampling opinion at random all around the country, we would take one college as a sort of capsule case study of how the news hit the draft eligibles at our colleges. We went down to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and asked for reactions. First, Dick Murphy, a member of the student government.
If the federal government is going to defer boys because of their scholastic ability, I feel they have sort of an obligation to see to it that those boys who have a high degree of ability will not be kept from going to college merely because they cannot afford to pay for it. In other words, some series of federal scholarships, perhaps.
Here is Roy Parker, editor of the Tar Heel, the student daily.
We think the measure is a very good stopgap idea until universal military training can function correctly. If it were permanent, we think it would make colleges havens for any moderately intelligent draft dodge who could get enough money to come to college.
Wilma Jones, a senior.
Speaking for co-ed, the general opinion is that if the particular man you're interested in has a good chance of passing the test and staying in school, it's a good thing. But if you're not quite sure about that, well, it brings in a different angle.
Carl Snavely, one of the most famous football coaches in the country.
I feel that it is a very wise provision, a very important one for the benefit of our educational institutions, and I think eventually for the country as a whole. Our football players will always be ready to answer any call that's made upon them, but I do think it's important that our athletic program in general be saved, and it might not have survived the wholesale depletion of our schools and colleges.
Now, the president of the University of North Carolina and former Secretary of the Army, Gordon Gray.
I must say very frankly that it gives me some concern, because I fear that people will conceive of it as a development of an intellectual aristocracy. And I'm afraid there will be a lot of anti-high education feeling.
Barbara Lind, a junior.
I think it's a good thing. I think it's very important that the fellows be allowed to finish their education before going to the service, if it is possible. I believe that fighting for our country is a very important thing, and fighting for the things that we have here in America, but education is important, too, and people have a hard time getting along these days unless they do have an educational background, I believe.
And another point concerning the plight of the very brilliant student who just can't afford to go to college. Here is Oliver Cornwell of the faculty.
Well, it's my opinion that it's discriminatory that it allows boys probably to attend college, the determining factor being the economic setup that provide the resources for them to go to school. I think probably it would be all right if everyone had equal opportunity, not only academically, but in terms of the economics of the thing.
But deferring college students was just one problem confronting colleges this week. The question of admitting Negro students to graduate law schools was up in South Carolina. In a recent speech, Governor James Burns of South Carolina stated his position.
The court should uphold the doctrine of separate but equal facilities. 50-year-old doctrine, instead of ordering that segregation be abolished. Should the Supreme Court decide this case against our position, we will face a serious problem. Of only one thing can we be certain, if I know the people of South Carolina. South Carolina will not now nor for some years to come mixed white and colored children in our schools.
Dr. Ralph Bunch, Nobel Prize winner and UN official, had something to say about the governor's attitude.
Anti-Negro bitter enders, like anti-labor bitter enders, persist, of course, particularly in the South. But they are making a last stand. It is shocking, surely, now to find James F. Byrne joining Herman Talmadge in the forefront of them. I say shocking not because it was Burns, governor of South Carolina, but Burns, former Supreme Court Justice and Secretary of State, who recently declared, if the press quoted him accurately, that he would have his state go so far as to abandon the public school system altogether, rather than bow to any decision of the federal courts which would call for an end to segregation. Who, indeed, could be in better position than Burns to know how costly are such undemocratic declarations and practices to our foreign relations, to our international reputation for democracy, to our prestige and our leadership?
There was another school in the news this week. In a little red schoolhouse in a pine grove in Sudbury, Massachusetts, near Boston, the roll was called for one of the last times.
Good morning, children.
Good morning, Mrs. Bennett.
Let's have the roll call.
Soon, this prim little one-room schoolhouse will cease to be. It's running out of pupils. It'll probably never be destroyed because it was here that a piece of poetry was written. For many Americans, it was the first verse they ever learned. Here it was that Mary and her little lamb went to school. John Rulston wrote the 12 lines of rhyme for Mary, born 145 years ago.
As you all know, children, our little school is closing in June. And you also realize that the Redstone School is famous the world over. And for one of the last time, let's recite the little poem that we say each week. You may stand.
Mary has a linen that sleeps with the brightest snow, and everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go. He followed her to school one day, that was against the rules. It made the children laugh and play to see a lamb at school.
You are listening to Hear It Now, CBS's weekly document for air based on the week's news. The program continues immediately after this pause for station identification. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is WDWS AM and FM in Champaign-Urbana. Men, if you like gabardine, you'll love Plateau, the famous suit with a weightless feel made only by Timely Clothes. Exclusive in the Twin Cities at Pat Kane's 202 North Neal in Champaign. Stop in and see their fine selection of Plateau suits. Just ask for Plateau by Timely Clothes at Pat Kane's. The suit that's tops in style and comfort. You wear it the year round.
On Hear It Now, a full hour review of the week's news, told in the actual recorded voices of the men and women who make the news. Once again, here is the editor of Hear It Now, Edward R. Murrow. We live today in a world of perpetual crisis. Our standards are down. Our perspective is hazy. And we find ourselves increasingly filled with doubts, fears, and suspicions. As we search for the magic formula, something to grab onto, we can't escape the realization in a world so grotesquely distorted that it is a very fine thread indeed that separates the real and the make-believe. Times have changed, and we've been forced to change with them, for better or for worse. But this week, the circus came to New York. It's changed, too. There are more girls and fewer animals, more spectacles and fewer sensations. But the fat lady is no thinner, and the midgets are no taller. The clowns are still funny, and the acrobats still daring. For a couple of hours, at least, you find yourself in a world of your own making, bordered only by your own dreams and imagination. And that's as it should be at the circus. Fred Allen once said, "If a circus is half as good as it smells, it's a great show." This, then, is the smell of the circus on opening night as our recorders roamed over Madison Square Garden.
So many programs, all about the circus, Ringling Brothers, Barnum Bailey's program.
Don't forget your peanuts and Cracker Jacks for the show.
Introducing baby Irene, 540 pounds of her.
A quick look at the sideshow first.
I weighed 12 pounds. Now I'm 33 years old, weighed 540 pounds. And you boys looking for a real domestic wife? That is, wouldn't it would keep you nice and shady in the summertime? Warm in the winter? I just look me over.
Curtain call for the circus crew.
Don't hurry going up. You have plenty of time to get up. If you can't get it off, tear it off.
Fine, what's your hurry?
What am I hurrying? I'm going on right now. The elephant's in the way.
Backstage, the horses get ready, too.
You're all set here, Saddler boy. Now, let's take a minute now. Banker, cut that chewing. Oh, hurry. Don't be nervous. Hurry. Look at Darby.
An intimate moment.
When you go up there.
Oh, of course I wouldn't want to lose my costume.
Oh, you won't lose your costume, but you'll have to break your neck.
This is it.